My friends, we're taking a series of passages at the moment from 1 Corinthians, and you can be looking at the Bible now, the seat which is near you, and turning to 1 Corinthians in chapter 1, where we had our second reading. This series of studies we're calling Getting It Straight, because never was there a more mixed up church than the church at Corinth. It needed straightening, helping, and correcting. And today we come to the third in our series of studies, which is called Essence and Offense. We're thinking of a mixed up church here. A church that got practically everything in its church government wrong, and in its life and order. It got the whole question of the place of women in the church completely wrong and muddled. They got the collection wrong, the gifts of the Spirit were wrong. Everything that it had was a little bit distorted, a little bit out of straight. And they were being infected also by the spirit of the age, which was an age of Greek philosophy coupled with one of Judaism and the questing after the power associated with the hope of a coming Messiah. And in many ways, it had rubbed off onto the church of Corinth. They were also obsessed with power. They were also somewhat obsessed with wisdom of a worldly kind. It was a very difficult city. So we look at our key sentence, and we're looking at verses 18 to 31 of 1 Corinthians chapter 1. It's a wonderful passage. Here we read about the essence of the gospel, but we also read about the offense that it caused. We read about these words here, wisdom, folly, power, the cross. And the key verse, I think the key verse is verse 23. We'll start there. We preach Christ crucified, a stumbling block to Jews and folly to Gentiles, but to those who are called, both Jews and Greeks, Christ, the power of God and the wisdom of God. We preach Christ crucified. Essence and offense. John Pollock, in his Life of Paul, comments on the ancient city of Corinth. He says, if the love of Christ Jesus could take root in Corinth, the most populated, wealthy, commercial-minded, and sex-obsessed city of Eastern Europe, it must prove powerful anywhere. Because Corinth was sin city. It numbered about 250,000 people. It was about 100 years old. It was right on the coast. And being a port, it was associated with all the vice that a port is often associated with. Overlooked by the great temple of Aphrodite, it gloried unashamedly in strident immorality. The city's name was a synonym for lust and debauchery. Stage dramas of that time invariably introduced Corinthians into the drama as staggering drunks. But it was here that a church took root during Paul the Apostle's two-year stay, a shining triumph of the cross. Yes, it is the cross, really, upon which our thoughts and gaze are focused tonight. We preach Christ crucified, said Paul, to these Christians who are often being taken away from the cross, sidetracked by other interests. The cross has always been an offense in society. People won't mind sometimes an anemic religion of ethics and morality because it leaves them alone, but bring in the cross and we often react. So it was in Paul's day. To the Jews, a crucified Messiah was an impossibility. Indeed, a very grave insult, because anyone who was crucified was supposed to be under God's curse. And here were the Jews. They said to themselves, we are supposed to be the light of the nations, and we are not enjoying being under Roman imperial rule and domination. We are looking for the Messiah who will liberate us. Then when they were told, this is the Messiah, one who has been crucified upon a cross, they were disgusted and ashamed. They wanted signs. They wanted indications of power, temporal power, and they consistently got it wrong. What about the Greeks of Paul's day? The cross to them was simply nonsense. God, they maintained, would never act like that. It's irrational, and man's wisdom can surely devise a better way to God than that. We want wisdom. We want a rational philosophy. And yet, the crucifixion lies at the very core and kernel of Christianity. And Paul says, we preach Christ crucified. And the word preach here is in the original the word appropriate for a herald. In other words, the message of the cross is God's message, and the preacher is simply passing on the news he'd been given to impart. This, said Paul, is the power of God and the wisdom of God. So you want real power? He says to those Jews who are longing to see powerful signs in their midst. And it's saying it also to the Corinthians, who had been infected by something of this desire. You want power? Then you must come to the cross if you want to see God at work. You want wisdom? He said to the Greeks who were only interested in human systems, human wisdom. Then you must come to the cross if you want to see God's wisdom. So Paul includes all mankind in the rejection of the crucified Messiah. Because history has always thrown up these two classes. People who say, well, I want a sign. I could believe if I had proof. People say it today. I want something tangible, something visible. And then the people who say, I want something that is rational and comprehensible to my thinking. And anything beyond that is out. So the cross has been an offense to many people. We shouldn't be surprised when that happens. Are we surprised? Don't be surprised. If you're a new Christian and you find yourself trying to witness as best as you can to the power of Christ in your life by your example, maybe by the odd word dropped here and there, you may find people will react badly. Say, we don't want any of that. It's happened before. So my first little couplet of words is the word essence and offense. Look at verse 18. For the word of the cross is folly to those who are perishing. But to us who are being saved, it is the power of God. Essence and offense. It was an offense, as I have said. Cicero of old commented about crucifixion. It is the most cruel and shameful of all punishments. Let it never come near the body of a Roman citizen. Nay, neither near his thoughts or eyes or ears. Nearby, Douglas Webster of St. Paul's Cathedral has written, the gospel story is a murder story. It is a crime and there is blood. So to many it is shocking. The cross is an offense to many people. It repels us with its image. People say, blood? I don't mind a little gold cross hanging round my neck. Or seeing a cross on a building. But the idea of sacrifice is abhorrent in today's sophisticated society. That's why we have the communion regularly, to bring us back to the cross at the center, to remind us. It does repel many with its image. It convicts us of our need, because it says God loves you so much that he sent his son to die upon the cross, to receive in himself the responsibility for the sins that you have committed. You are a sinner. That is what the cross is saying to us, and we don't like it and we shrink. We say, please take it away. At the time of Wesley and Whitfield, the Dowager Duchess of Buckingham wrote a letter about those two evangelists of two centuries ago. I thank your ladyship for the information concerning the Methodist preachers. Their doctrines are most repulsive and strongly tinctured with impertinence and disrespect towards their superiors in perpetually endeavoring to level all ranks and do away with all distinction. It is monstrous, she continues, to be told that you have a heart as sinful as the common wretches that crawl on the earth. This is highly offensive. People feel like that today, with different terminology. It repels us with its image. It convicts us of our need. It challenges us with its standards. We had a baptism here a fortnight ago. Do you remember those two individuals? One from a Buddhist background, the other from a Jewish background. What a thrill it was to have those baptisms. And what were we doing? Put at one point the sign of the cross put on that person's forehead. Maybe you said, oh, how beautiful. Beautiful? It's awful. It's horrid. The sign of death upon a person's forehead was saying death to your past, death to self-interest, death to self-promotion, death to self-centeredness, death, death, death. That's what the cross is saying to us. And sometimes we don't like it when we're thinking about it in the future. And we say, am I really going to commit my life to this person who wants my old life to die? It challenges us with its standards. And then it tells us that there is only one way. For if there had been any other way to know the Father, Jesus Christ would never have died. For he prayed in the garden, if it be possible, let this cup pass from me. But there was no other way. So he went to the cross willingly. And therefore to say that there's another way is to insult Christ in his dying love. There's only one way. And the cross says, this is it. It's the essence. It's the heart of Christianity. It's God's masterpiece, the cross. Could you believe it in that first century? You couldn't really. People couldn't take it. It was too strong. We preach Christ crucified, said Paul. That's the essence of a Christianity that can renovate. It was folly to some, but to others, it was powerful. That's what it says here in verse 18. To preach Christ without the cross, it would be like writing a biography on Christine or Jane Torvill, those skaters, without making any reference to the world of ice skating. It'd be like putting a documentary together on TV on Neil Armstrong without any reference to the moon. It'd be like talking about Christopher Columbus without mentioning America. We preach Christ crucified, said Paul. That's the heart of it, the essence of it. And sometimes there are people who have tried to remove the concept of the crucifixion because they don't like it or don't understand it. So we read in the Quran today, he did not die. Neither did they crucify him. They had his likeness. I can understand the reason behind that. Because the understanding there is, God surely couldn't allow this to happen to such a holy, pure, innocent person. So he didn't die. He wasn't crucified. They found a substitute. The idea being in the end that it was Judas Iscariot, perhaps, who was crucified in his place so that he could be let free. Because people couldn't take it. The idea of the cross. It's the heart of it. Essence and offense. That's my first pair of couplets. I got a second. Wisdom and foolishness. Oh, you go through this passage. The number of times, did you spot it in the reading? How many times the word wisdom cropped up? And how many times the word folly or foolishness cropped up? You see, the Corinthians were beginning to rely upon a wisdom that was worldly wisdom in the church. And Paul was trying to correct them as to what real wisdom was. So we come to verse 19, for it is written, he said, and he was quoting from Isaiah 29, verse 14, it is written, I will destroy the wisdom of the wise, and the cleverness of the clever I will thwart. That's God speaking. What is he saying? He's not saying, look, that wisdom of the world, let's ignore it. He's saying, I will crush it. I will defeat it. Here was therefore a sort of watertight system of philosophy that the Greeks were trying to devise and were always trying to devise across the centuries with Plato and all those other great thinkers. Wisdom. And many people said, this is the way to fulfillment. This is the way to self-discovery. This is the way to understanding and enlightenment. Christianity says, no. The way ahead is through folly. So Paul asks in verse 20, where is the wise man? Where is the scribe? Where is the debater of this age? These rhetorical questions. Was Paul referring to the sages of Greece when he said, where is the wise man? Perhaps he was. And by the scribe, was he referring to the top Jewish leaders of the day? And by the debater of this day, did he mean to include both categories and any other that there might be? The top people, well-equipped intellectually, Here is the dynamic apostle of the New Testament challenging the wise, the top, the most brilliant people of his day to outperform the Christian gospel in getting people to know and find God. He was challenging them. Can you outdo us? The assumption in his mind clearly was, no, God has come to destroy your wisdom. The word wisdom there being the word in Greek, sophia. I looked it up, from which we get, of course, our word sophistication. Many times the word comes. In the Old Testament, the idea of wisdom seems to be that of making a success of your life. There's a practical aspect to it, biblically. And then the word foolishness, it's the word moron, M-O-R-O-N, from which, of course, we get our obvious word. What an extraordinary turnaround, that God destroys the wisdom of the wise through his foolishness. So we look at verse 21. For since in the wisdom of God the world did not know God through wisdom, it pleased God through the folly of what we preach to save those who believe. Oh, these great words like salvation and save, they get debased, I'm afraid, often. Sometimes when you get a really worn George VI, you know, 2-shilling piece in your pocket, it's been worn away a bit. Or sometimes you look at some of these old Victorian pennies, worn right away. It can happen with words, I'm afraid. Words can get spoilt, rubbed away. And we need again and again to come back to the Bible to see what is God's wisdom, what is his salvation. The world didn't know God, we read in verse 21. The world did not know God through wisdom. Where do you read about the testimony of failure in the world's wisdom? Where do you read that people have failed to come to God and to find fulfillment? On the side of a wigwam? No. Carved into stone on the slopes of Kilimanjaro? No. You don't find it there. No, you see it proclaimed in sophisticated Greek sculptures, on the marble wall of Athens or on the altar in Athens with its inscription to the unknown God. Failure on every side, but always struggling. The Egyptians had tried. The Babylonians had tried. It pleased God through the folly of what we preach, verse 22, to save those who believe. So there are the debaters of that age. Paul knew all about them. He entered into debate with them himself in the arena of his day. We do the same. Professor Haldane was lined up once against C.S. Lewis. In the end, Professor Haldane never turned up, or at least he left early, so the debate didn't properly take off. Everyone was looking forward to real fireworks, and they knew that C.S. Lewis would win. I heard a debate some years ago between some secular humanist and Lord Hailsham. Hailsham won. I was once in debate myself. Have you been in debate yet? Either personally or even publicly. Maybe in some of those Christian Union affairs. I was once challenged by the humanists in an Essex town to a debate. It was one against the rest. There were about 30 of them, and I was on my own. So I just got one other friend to come and just hold my hand. But I felt vulnerable as I walked in. I was the moron, you see. And in their eyes, they certainly thought I was. The interesting thing was that their numbers began to shrivel after our debate. Not that I felt I'd won particularly. At the end of it, I thought, well, maybe it's been a draw. I don't know. I wasn't sure if I'd won or not. But I noticed that their numbers are tiny today. Tiny. We have to take on the debaters of this world. And the Christian message is the most profound thing that you could ever stumble upon. And yet it's very simple. It has to be simple. Did you feel that with Billy Graham last week? Some of you who committed your lives to Christ last week, did you feel it was simple enough for you to cotton on to and to say, this is what is going to open up my life and renovate me as a person to know God and to be friends with him? It's very profound, but it's very simple. No one would doubt that Plato was intellectually a better equipped man than John the fisherman. But today, Plato is specialist reading for the esoteric few. It's armchair stuff for the study while John's Gospel is the biggest selling piece of literature in the history of the world. Plato is for the secluded study. John is for the refugee camp, the leprosy settlement, places where lives are being lived and fought about. You see, the word wisdom sometimes is replaced by the word power. Did you notice that? Look again at verse 18, would you? The word of the cross is folly to those who are perishing, but to us who are being saved, you could have thought it would be wisdom would be used here. It is the wisdom of God. He doesn't use the word wisdom here, although that would be the natural contrast. He uses the word power. Why is that? Think about it. The wisdom of God is practical. It impinges upon standards, choices, desires, and daily life. It actually changes life. It renovates life. I'll give you an example from this morning. If you're listening to the Sunday program, BBC 4, Radio 4, you'll have heard the story of a man who is running a pornography shop in Sheffield. And he spoke on the radio of how the local vicar had come to visit his shop. The vicar was my cousin. I've got many clergy, you know, in our family. We're riddled with clergy. My cousin went to visit him because he'd found a piece of this pornography with one of the choir boys had got hold of. So he took it to the shop and said, "You should not be selling this." And the man rebuffed him, but the vicar came back again a second time, this time with the parish magazine. Came back a third time and a fourth time, sometimes leaving literature, always a little word of witness, helping the man to come out from that pornography shop. And in the end, he left. In the end, he went to Africa for a trip. In the end, he found God in Africa and received forgiveness at the cross and now wants to put everything right. When we come to the wisdom of God, it actually renovates lives. It's practical. So we think about power in this matter. Salvation, you see, is put by the wisdom of God in reach of everybody through the apparent folly of the message. The abject failure of human philosophy is a feature of our history. The Bible comes back again and again to correct it. The biblical revelation. In opposition to atheism, the Bible proclaims God. In opposition to polytheism, the concept of many gods, it emphasizes one God. In opposition to pantheism, which identifies God with nature, the Bible declares the separateness of God from his creation. In opposition to materialism, it reveals the spirituality of God and man. In opposition to deism, the concept of an absentee God who has wound up the world and then just left it to its own devices, it declares that God the creator is also God the sustainer, and furthermore that he is God the intervener in the affairs of men. He is God the redeemer, the one who saves and renovates life. So what the Jew of Paul's time demanded was a series of signs, visions, a demonstration of power. What the Greek was interested in was a satisfying source of wisdom, a watertight system. What the Christian found, says Paul, was power and wisdom in one. So that the fear of the Lord is the beginning of wisdom, we read in Proverbs chapter 9 and verse 10. That's where wisdom is to be found, in knowing God, in submitting to his rule in our lives. And it's made available to us through the cross. Incredibly, the cross fulfilled the desires of both types of seeker. The Jews would say, "How shameful, a crucified Messiah." The Greeks said, "How ridiculous, a person." We believed in a system of sophistry, but not this absurd spectacle. In the end, writes Stephen Neal, a point comes when intellect has done its utmost and lays down its arms. Here's a renovating power through the cross, open to all. It has to be universal. It has to be open to the people who are not clever, not academic, not intellectual. When I was a little boy, I remember running round the house where we used to live in East Africa in a game with my brother, two of my brothers, both my brothers. And as we were running round, chasing one another, my mother was conducting a baptism interview on the veranda with an old senior Kikuyu lady who was wanting to be baptized and coming out of traditional religion of animism into Christianity. My mother said she was very dim. She told me this later. Very dim indeed. She said, "Now, tell me something about Jesus. Tell me some of the things he did." "Oh," said the woman, with a shawl over her head, right over her head, "don't ask me these questions. I'm tired and old. I can't cope." "Well," said my mother, we were still running around the house, "tell me, what was the name of Jesus' mother?" At that point, my brother flashed by and whispered in her ear, "Mary." So she said, "Mary." My mother said, "Well, I'm afraid you were told that. Tell me something else." "Oh," she said, I don't think I can tell you any more." So my mother, who is the sort of inquisitor, said, "Well, perhaps we should delay baptism until you have more light, because it would be ridiculous to be baptized unless you have a personal testimony." At the word testimony, the lady whipped the shawl off her head, looked up with shining eyes into the eyes of my mother, and said, "Testimony? Of course I've got a testimony. How the Lord Jesus Christ came into my life to put me right, to take away all the sins of witchcraft that have been in my life. He's given me forgiveness of sins. He's brought me to himself. I'm on the road to heaven. How can you say I haven't got a testimony?" She was very dim, and yet she had the wisdom that the cross gives. That's the marvelous thing about it. I met a theologian once, studying theology in Durham University. I said this in June last year in a sermon. And I said to this man, "You're studying theology?" "Yeah," I said, "but you are an agnostic, you tell me." "Yes," he said, "I'm an agnostic." I said, "Why are you studying theology?" He said, I shall never forget his reply, "It amuses me." I said to him, "The newest, greenest, rawest recruit to Jesus Christ will outdo you, because you will never find God that way. You cannot find God that way because you find it so vastly entertaining." You see, he was a Greek, really. He was like a Greek of Paul's day. The woman in Kikuyu country, she was far ahead of him, and I told him that. Intellect is of importance, but it's not the essential factor. It's not the basis on which we can find meaning, significance, personhood, and God. John Berridge, who lived two centuries ago, declared at the time of the great Wesley revival that for 6 years he preached morality to his parishioners at Stapleford until there was hardly a moral person in the parish. After that, he learned from these other preachers to uphold the crucified Christ, and the people came flocking into the church because through the cross, heaven was opened. Essence and offense, wisdom and foolishness. There are contrasts here. And last, as I close, greatness and weakness. Look at verse 26. "Consider your call, brethren. Not many of you were wise, according to worldly standards. Not many were powerful. Not many were of noble birth. But God chose what is foolish in the world to shame the wise. God chose what is weak in the world to shame the strong. God chose what is low and despised in the world, even things that are not, to bring to nothing things that are." Greatness and weakness. Consider your call, says Paul there in verse 26. Consider your call. How did the call come to you? John Bunyan evidently once said, "The hen has two calls, the common cluck, which she gives hourly, and the special one, which she means for her little chickens." The general call goes out from the gospel to the whole world. It's universal. Then comes God's special call to you and me. It came to some of you last week, I know. And when it comes to us, we've begun in the wisdom and the strength of God. I'm glad it says here that not many were of noble birth. I'm glad he doesn't say not any, but not many. Because we may find that again and again we meet up with people who are prominent, they couldn't care less, very busy, and it doesn't say anything to them. And yet there is that special call that comes to people, and it came to you, came to me. God uses the weak people. Now, not even those who apparently in the sight of the world are weak, but he uses the genuinely weak to effect his purposes. I was in a sixth form meeting some time ago and trying to communicate as best as I could. And at the end of it, when we had the discussion time and we mixed up and had coffee, I said to one person who was there, who was very worldly, from a very rich background, very accomplished, very intellectual, I said to him, "Why are you here?" Because he wasn't a believer. "Why are you here?" He said, "I'm here because of him." And he pointed across the room to a very insignificant-looking individual who looked like nothing, really. Didn't look at all accomplished. Looked like a little mouse, if anything. And yet, this person said to me, "I came because of him because I admire his lifestyle. There's integrity in it. His life holds together in a way that mine does not. And I wanted to find out what it is that makes him as he is." God uses the weak. A friend of our family's was searching for God for many years, many years. She tried various churches and she didn't seem to find anything that satisfied. She went around asking friends. She got confirmed in a church. And in despair, because she still could not find God, she was walking along the road and she saw a small girl. This was a Sunday afternoon. And the girl was crying. The girl was of about seven. So, like a proper grown-up, she stopped by and said, "Oh, what's the matter? Can I help? Something gone wrong?" "Oh, no," said the girl. "I've asked Jesus into my life. I'm so happy. I can't stop crying." But the woman said, "But that's what I want. How did you do it? What did you do?" she asked. And the girl said, "I can't tell you." She said, "But you go along to that hall there and they'll tell you." She went and they told her. And that day she began in the wisdom and power of God. Today she's a missionary. God uses the weak things. You and I may feel very, very weak. It's good that we do so. At the time of the Roman Empire, what was Christianity? It was nothing. Who was Paul? You can imagine Nero or one of these other great emperors saying, "Christianity is that little sect. And that man who leads them, Paul, as you say the name was, who is he?" "Oh," they say, "a tent maker." "Tent maker? And what are his disciples like?" "Oh, well, bunch of women he met at the riverside in Philippi." "Right." Didn't sound at all threatening. But in the end, the Roman Empire bit the dust while the Christian cause plodded on. Jupiter was it in those days. Diana was it. Aphrodite, they were the ones that mattered, but not forever. There was little Paul facing, as we do today, the great established falsehoods in modern thinking. And God says, "I will demolish them with my wisdom, my power." So essence and offense, wisdom and foolishness, greatness and weakness. God chooses the low and despised. Then he goes on at the very end, as we finish, "He's the source of your life in Christ Jesus, whom God made our," here are the theological words, "wisdom, righteousness, sanctification, and redemption." Wisdom covers it, and underneath it are those words, righteousness, that's me being put right with God. Sanctification, me becoming more like God in my character and life. And redemption, being one for God, being one of his forever, bought by him, by the power of the cross. Christ, the power of God, and the wisdom of God. What a passage.